Chapter 84. We cast up the account. It footed up pretty fairly. There was nothing more at Jerusalem to be seen, except the traditional houses of Dives and Lazarus of the parable, the tombs of the kings, and those of the judges, the spot where they stoned one of the disciples to death, and beheaded another, the room and the table made celebrated by the Last Supper, the fig tree that Jesus withered, a number of historical places about Gethsemane and the Mount of Olives, and 15 or 20 others in different portions of the city itself. We were approaching the end. Human nature asserted itself now. Overwork and consequent exhaustion began to have their natural effect. They began to master the energies and dull the ardor of the party. Perfectly secure now, against failing to accomplish any detail of the pilgrimage, they felt like drawing in advance upon the holiday soon, to be placed to their credit. They grew a little lazy. They were late to breakfast, and sat long at dinner. 30 or 40 pilgrims had arrived from the ship, by the short routes, and much swapping of gossip had to be indulged in. And in hot afternoons, they showed a strong disposition to lie on the cool divans in the hotel, and smoke and talk about pleasant experiences of a month or so gone by, for even thus early do episodes of travel which were sometimes annoying, sometimes exasperating and full as often of no consequence at all when they transpired, begin to rise above the dead level of monotonous reminiscences, and become shapely landmarks in one's memory. The fog whistle, smothered among a million of trifling sounds, is not noticed a block away, in the city, but the sailor hears it far at sea, whither none of those thousands of trifling sounds can reach. When one is in Rome, all the domes are alike, but when he has gone away 12 miles, the city fades utterly from sight, and leaves St. Peter's swelling above the level plain like an anchored balloon. When one is traveling in Europe, the daily incidents seem all alike, but when he has placed them all 2 months, and 2,000 miles behind him, those that were worthy of being remembered are prominent, and those that were really insignificant have vanished. This disposition to smoke, and idle and talk, was not well. It was plain that it must not be allowed to gain ground. A diversion must be tried, or demoralization would ensue. The Jordan, Jericho, and the Dead Sea were suggested. The remainder of Jerusalem must be left unvisited, for a little while. The journey was approved at once. New life stirred in every pulse. In the saddle abroad on the plains, sleeping in beds bounded only by the horizon, fancy was at work with these things in a moment. It was painful to note how readily these town-bred men had taken to the free life of the camp and the desert. The nomadic instinct is a human instinct. It was born with Adam and transmitted through the patriarchs, and after 30 centuries of steady effort, civilization has not educated it entirely out of us yet. It has a charm which, once tasted, a man will yearn to taste again. The nomadic instinct cannot be educated out of an Indian at all. The Jordan journey being approved, our dragoman was notified. At 9 in the morning the caravan was before the hotel door and we were at breakfast. There was a commotion about the place. Rumors of war and bloodshed were flying everywhere. The lawless Bedouins in the valley of the Jordan, and the deserts down by the Dead Sea were up in arms, and were going to destroy all comers. They had had a battle with a troop of Turkish cavalry and defeated them, several men killed. They had shut up the inhabitants of a village, and a Turkish garrison in an old fort near Jericho, and were besieging them. They had marched upon a camp of our excursionists by the Jordan, and the pilgrims only saved their lives by stealing away, and flying to Jerusalem under whip and spur in the darkness of the night. Another of our parties had been fired on from an ambush, and then attacked in the open day. Shots were fired on both sides. Fortunately, there was no bloodshed. We spoke with the very pilgrim who had fired one of the shots, and learned from his own lips how, in this imminent deadly peril, only the cool courage of the pilgrims, their strength of numbers and imposing display of war material, had saved them from utter destruction. It was reported that the consul had requested that no more of our pilgrims should go to the Jordan while this state of things lasted, and further, that he was unwilling that any more should go, at least without an unusually strong military guard. Here was trouble. But with the horses at the door, and everybody aware of what they were there for, what would you have done? Acknowledged that you were afraid, and backed shamefully out? Hardly. It would not be human nature, where there were so many women. You would have done as we did. Said you were not afraid of a million Bedouins and made your will and proposed quietly to yourself to take up an unostentatious position in the rear of the procession. I think we must all have determined upon the same line of tactics, for it did seem as if we never would get to Jericho. I had a notoriously slow horse, but somehow I could not keep him in the rear, to save my neck. He was forever turning up in the lead. In such cases I trembled a little, and got down to fix my saddle. But it was not of any use. The others all got down to fix their saddles too. I never saw such a time with saddles. It was the first time any of them had got out of order in 3 weeks, and now they had all broken down at once. I tried walking, for exercise I had not had enough in Jerusalem searching for holy places. But it was a failure. The whole mob were suffering for exercise, and it was not 15 minutes till they were all on foot, and I had to lead again. It was very discouraging. This was all, after we got beyond Bethany. We stopped at the village of Bethany, an hour out from Jerusalem. They showed us the tomb of Lazarus. I had rather live in it than in any house in the town. And they showed us also a large fountain of Lazarus, and in the center of the village the ancient dwelling of Lazarus. Lazarus appears to have been a man of property. The legends of the Sunday schools do him great injustice. They give one the impression that he was poor. It is because they get him confused with that Lazarus who had no merit but his virtue, and virtue never has been as respectable as money. The house of Lazarus is a 3-story edifice, of stone masonry, but the accumulated rubbish of ages has buried all of it, but the upper story. We took candles and descended to the dismal cell-like chambers, where Jesus sat at meat with Martha and Mary, and conversed with them about their brother. We could not but look upon these old dingy apartments with a more than common interest. We had had a glimpse, from a mountaintop, of the Dead Sea, lying like a blue shield in the plain of the Jordan, and now we were marching down a close, flaming, rugged, desolate defile, where no living creature could enjoy life, except, perhaps, a salamander. It was such a dreary, repulsive, horrible solitude. It was the wilderness where John preached, with camel's hair about his loins, raiment enough, but he never could have got his locusts and wild honey here. We were moping along down through this dreadful place, every man in the rear. Our guards, two gorgeous young Arab sheiks, with cargoes of swords, guns, pistols, and daggers on board, were loafing ahead. Bedouins. Every man shrunk up and disappeared in his clothes like a mud turtle. My first impulse was to dash forward and destroy the Bedouins. My second was to dash to the rear to see if there were any coming in that direction. I acted on the latter impulse. So did all the others. If any Bedouins had approached us, then, from that point of the compass, they would have paid dearly for their rashness. We all remarked that, afterwards. There would have been scenes of riot and bloodshed there that no pen could describe. I know that, because each man told what he would have done, individually, and such a medley of strange and unheard of inventions of cruelty you could not conceive of. One man said he had calmly made up his mind to perish where he stood, if need be, but never yield an inch. He was going to wait, with deadly patience, till he could count the stripes upon the first Bedouin's jacket, and then count them, and let him have it. Another was going to sit still till the first lance reached within an inch of his breast, and then dodge it and seize it. I forbear to tell what he was going to do to that Bedouin that owned it. It makes my blood run cold to think of it. Another was going to scalp such Bedouins as fell to his share, and take his bald-headed sons of the desert home with him alive for trophies. But the wild-eyed pilgrim Rhapsodist was silent. His orbs gleamed with a deadly light, but his lips moved not. Anxiety grew, and he was questioned. If he had got a Bedouin, what would he have done with him? Shot him. He smiled a smile of grim contempt, and shook his head. Would he have stabbed him? Another shake. Would he have quartered him, flayed him? More shakes. Oh! Or what would he have done? Eat him. Such was the awful sentence that thundered from his lips. What was grammar to a desperado like that? I was glad in my heart that I had been spared the scenes of malignant carnage. No Bedouins attacked our terrible rear, and none attacked the front. The newcomers were only a reinforcement of cadaverous Arabs, in shirts and bare legs, sent far ahead of us to brandish rusty guns, and shout and brag, and carry on like lunatics, and thus scare away all bands of marauding Bedouins that might lurk about our path. What a shame it is that armed white Christians must travel under guard of vermin like this as a protection against the prowling vagabonds of the desert, those sanguinary outlaws who are always going to do something desperate, but never do it. I may as well mention here that on our whole trip we saw no Bedouins, and had no more use for an Arab guard than we could have had for patent leather boots and white kid gloves. The Bedouins that attacked the other parties of pilgrims so fiercely were provided for the occasion by the Arab guards of those parties, and shipped from Jerusalem for temporary service as Bedouins. They met together in full view of the pilgrims, after the battle, and took lunch, divided the bucksheesh extorted in the season of danger, and then accompanied the cavalcade home to the city. The nuisance of an Arab guard is one which is created by the sheiks and the Bedouins together, for mutual profit, it is said, and no doubt there is a good deal of truth in it. We visited the fountain the Prophet Elisha sweetened, it is sweet yet, where he remained some time, and was fed by the ravens. Ancient Jericho is not very picturesque as a ruin. When Joshua marched around it 7 times, some 3,000 years ago, and blew it down with his trumpet, he did the work so well and so completely, that he hardly left enough of the city to cast a shadow. The curse pronounced against the rebuilding of it has never been removed. One king, holding the curse in light estimation, made the attempt, but was stricken sorely for his presumption. Its site will always remain unoccupied. And yet it is one of the very best locations for a town we have seen in all Palestine. At 2 in the morning they routed us out of bed, another piece of unwarranted cruelty, another stupid effort of our dragoman, to get ahead of a rival. It was not 2 hours to the Jordan. However, we were dressed, and underway before anyone thought of looking, to see what time it was, and so we drowsed on through the chill night air and dreamed of campfires, warm beds, and other comfortable things. There was no conversation. People do not talk when they are cold, and wretched, and sleepy. We nodded in the saddle, at times, and woke up with a start to find that the procession had disappeared in the gloom. Then there was energy and attention to business until its dusky outlines came in sight again. Occasionally the order was passed in a low voice down the line, colon, close up, close up. Bedouins lurk here, everywhere. What an exquisite shudder it sent shivering along one's spine. We reached the famous river before 4 o'clock, and the night was so black that we could have ridden into it without seeing it. Some of us were in an unhappy frame of mind. We waited and waited for daylight, but it did not come. Finally we went away in the dark, and slept an hour on the ground, in the bushes, and caught cold. It was a costly nap, on that account, but otherwise it was a paying investment, because it brought unconsciousness of the dreary minutes, and put us in a somewhat fitter mood for a first glimpse of the sacred river. With the first suspicion of dawn, every pilgrim took off his clothes, and waded into the dark torrent, singing. En Jordan's stormy banks I stand, and cast a wistful eye to Canaan's fair and happy land, where my possessions lie. But they did not sing long. The water was so fearfully cold that they were obliged to stop singing and scamper out again. Then they stood on the bank shivering, and so chagrined and so grieved that they merited holiest compassion. Because another dream, another cherished hope, had failed. They had promised themselves all along that they would cross the Jordan, where the Israelites crossed it when they entered Canaan from their long pilgrimage in the desert. They would cross where the 12 stones were placed in memory of that great event. While they did it, they would picture to themselves that vast army of pilgrims marching through the cloven waters, bearing the hallowed Ark of the Covenant and shouting hosannas, and singing songs of thanksgiving and praise. Each had promised himself that he would be the first to cross. They were at the goal of their hopes at last, but the current was too swift, the water was too cold. It was then that Jack did them a service. With that engaging recklessness of consequences which is natural to youth, and so proper and so seemly, as well, he went and led the way across the Jordan, and all was happiness again. Every individual waded over then, and stood upon the further bank. The water was not quite breast deep anywhere. If it had been more, we could hardly have accomplished the feat, for the strong current would have swept us down the stream, and we would have been exhausted and drowned, before reaching a place where we could make a landing. The main object compassed, the drooping, miserable party sat down to wait for the sun again, for all wanted to see the water as well as feel it. But it was too cold a pastime. Some cans were filled from the holy river, some canes cut from its banks, and then we mounted, and rode reluctantly away, to keep from freezing to death. So we saw the Jordan very dimly. The thickets of bushes that bordered its banks threw their shadows across its shallow, turbulent waters. Tormi, the hymn makes them, which is rather a complimentary stretch of fancy, and we could not judge of the width of the stream by the eye. We knew by our wading experience, however, that many streets in America are double as wide as the Jordan. Daylight came, soon after we got underway, and in the course of an hour or two we reached the Dead Sea. Nothing grows in the flat, burning desert around it, but weeds and the Dead Sea apple, the poets say, is beautiful to the eye, but crumbles to ashes and dust when you break it. Such as we found were not handsome, but they were bitter to the taste. They yielded no dust. It was because they were not ripe, perhaps. The desert and the barren hills gleam painfully in the sun, around the Dead Sea, and there is no pleasant thing or living creature upon it, or about its borders to cheer the eye. It is a scorching, arid, repulsive solitude. A silence broods over the scene that is depressing to the spirits. It makes one think of funerals and death. The Dead Sea is small. Its waters are very clear, and it has a pebbly bottom, and is shallow for some distance out from the shores. It yields quantities of asphaltum. Fragments of it lie all about its banks. This stuff gives the place something of an unpleasant smell. All our reading had taught us to expect that the first plunge into the Dead Sea would be attended with distressing results. Our bodies would feel as if they were suddenly pierced by millions of red-hot needles. The dreadful smarting would continue for hours. We might even look to be blistered from head to foot, and suffer miserably for many days. We were disappointed. Our eight sprang in at the same time that another party of pilgrims did, and nobody screamed once. None of them ever did complain of anything more than a slight pricking sensation in places where their skin was abraded, and then only for a short time. My face smarted for a couple of hours, but it was partly because I got it badly sunburned while I was bathing, and stayed in so long that it became plastered over with salt. No, the water did not blister us. It did not cover us with a slimy ooze and confer upon us an atrocious fragrance. It was not very slimy, and I could not discover that we smelt really any worse than we have always smelt since we have been in Palestine. It was only a different kind of smell, but not conspicuous on that account, because we have a great deal of variety in that respect. We didn't smell, there on the Jordan, the same as we do in Jerusalem. And we don't smell in Jerusalem just as we did in Nazareth, or Tiberias, or Caesarea Philippi, or any of those other ruinous ancient towns in Galilee. No, we change all the time, and generally for the worse. We do our own washing. It was a funny bath. We could not sing. One could stretch himself at full length on his back, with his arms on his breast, and all of his body above a line drawn from the corner of his jaw past the middle of his side, the middle of his leg, and through his ankle bone, would remain out of water. He could lift his head clear out, if he chose. No position can be retained long. You lose your balance and whirl over, first on your back, and then on your face, and so on. You can lie comfortably, on your back, with your head out, and your legs out from your knees down, by steadying yourself with your hands. You can sit, with your knees drawn. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.